historian, and he's going to talk about fashion in our books.
Just to begin, I have some confessions and apologies to make before we go any further. I have not read every novel in the corpus. I am not biologically related to Nero Wolfe. And alas, I am not in possession of so much as a law degree. So, nonetheless, my background is in fashion history and cultural criticism and the development of intellectual movements, particularly in America and Britain in the 20th century. So I'm gonna address a lot of those issues within the Nero Wolfe novels, and I'm gonna leave a little bit of extra time for questions at the end so that you guys can sort of allow me to respond to some particulars if you have any questions about how detective novels broadly or Nero Wolfe function within a set of popular cultural aesthetics. So first, I don't know how familiar you guys are with the rise of the pulp novel and the history of detective fiction. Detective fiction historically comes out of a couple of different events and changes, particularly in the mid to late 19th century. You have the improvement and standardization of education, which is, from a historiographical standpoint, extremely important because you have a rise of literacy. Obviously, if people can't read, they're not reading any sort of novels, let alone newspapers, magazines, or pulps. So printing technology also improves with the rise of spindle presses. This is sort of a huge moment in around 1870 to 1890, particularly also with the development of mass-produced paper. Prior to about 1845, 1850, most paper was cotton rag-based. It was extremely difficult to produce. It was very expensive. And books were typically sold in boards and then bound by their owner. Books could cost anywhere from $1 to $4 a piece from around 1810 to 1880, 1890. That's a lot of money. So the average person was not buying books. Books are something that only means to be very, very elite to afford. So we have this paper, which actually gives rise to the genre name, pulp. It's a lignin-based paper made out of shredding wood fiber particles. From a historical preservation standpoint, it's atrocious because it ages, it's destroyed, it's organic, it's terrible. But it's cheap, so people start reading it. That also has a lot to do with the development of newspapers and magazines, because you could produce these things much more cheaply using devices like saddle staplers and spindle presses. So we also have, at the time when the detective novels start becoming popular, the height of the Depression, sort of when they start really developing a dominant cultural influence. And this has a lot to do with a Christian moral ethic that really is sort of engaged counterculturally at the idea of government paralysis and the idea of state functional inaction. The idea that the government cannot solve your problems. The idea that justice is not necessarily something meted out by the government or even a state actor of any sort. So this is a huge moment during the Depression when people start to think, you know, maybe a private citizen could dole out justice. The whole Robin Hood concept, and even tying into the Horatio Alger stories, these become very popular pulp novels, not just for children, but also for adults. From a fashion perspective, fashion functions in detective novels as a kind of shorthand. It's an essential component rhetorically. It positions minor characters within the tale internally, giving them a sense of their wealth, their position in society. We call that dual positioning in cultural studies. And it also makes the principal into a distinct human performed identity brand, which obviously, as you all know, Nero Wolfe has his own sort of distinctive traits that make him Nero Wolfe as opposed to Hercule Poirot, as opposed to Sherlock Holmes. Fashion tends to be the single most dominant part of this kind of identity creation. If you look at even a detective like Columbo on television, Hercule Poirot, you cannot think of a detective whose fashion choices are not their single most dominant identity marker, as we call them. From a perspective of Wolfe, Wolfe is typically cast outside of his cultural moment. He comes to rise during late Art Deco and modernism. Wolfe is distinctly anti-modern. He has a Beaux-Arts sensibility, both in terms of decor. He has an interest in the organic and the non-functional, such as the orchids. He also is cast against dominant ideologies like temperance. He liked beer, and not the 3.2 stuff. In terms of his lifestyle aesthetic, food, clothes, decor, gardening, and his manner of speech all play into this. Eccentricity, refinement, and discerning taste, his interest in detail, highlight his intelligence and his precision. This is his own sort of eccentricity. It's a standard trope within detective novels, unfortunately. This is not something new that Stout did. Stout does a lot of new and kind of interesting things with Wolfe from a cultural studies standpoint, the fashion, the taste, the discernment, right in there with everybody else. From Archie as Foyle, I would actually, one of our speakers before sort of referred to him as the idiot friend. I would have to disagree. I think that's more of a Freudian Gemeinemann perspective. The idea that someone like Nero Wolfe is not relatable to the average person, nor is Hercule Poirot, nor is Sherlock Holmes. From a standpoint of visual aesthetics, he's not relatable. He's not intellectually or cognitively relatable. So what we do is we need a sort of safety valve to approach him, and the safety valve is our narrator, which creates a kind of interesting parallax perspective in the Wolfe series, and it's obviously used with, you know, Chief Inspector Japp and Hastings in other the Poirot series. Clothing is a barrier. Clothing is used here to create physical and aesthetic differences from others. Other people dress the way they would have in the period. Nero Wolfe does not. He retains his kind of anti-modern sensibility. The most obvious would also be his aversion to physical contact. Clothing is typically seen within the cultural studies realm and historically as a kind of physical barrier and a presentation of identity that casts us apart from other people. It is most literally a physical barrier to other human beings. Also, he has a sociological distance from state power, which has a lot to do with clothing. So Nero Wolfe wears what we call an anti-uniform as the presentation of his constructed identity, whereas state actors in the series, like Kramer and others, often wear uniforms or have badges representational of state authority. Nero Wolfe is not a state actor. That's extremely important from a linguistic and sociological assessment of the series. He is a private citizen. And he does what he does out of a arguably Calvinist sense of good, but also for profit. He makes money. So he is engaged in a kind of high Calvinist, moralist, capitalist enterprise, which is a little bit complex from a historical perspective. I would argue it's not quite a Quaker sensibility, especially given his imbibing and his relations or lack of relations with women. In terms of plot mechanics, Archie often wears costumes, which we tend to misperceive today. Costumes seem like a sort of hokey trope. They weren't at the time. Costumes were extremely important because people didn't own a whole lot of clothing. You might have three pairs of pants. So the idea that somebody would don a different set of garments and present their identity differently was a high-functioning item at the time. That would have really worked. You could dress up as a policeman and people would believe that you were a policeman. Today, we have a much more sophisticated sense of credentialing, both visually and intellectually, in terms of the way someone presents their identity. In terms of how they wear it, we all know Nero Wolfe's clothes are always nicely pressed. Everything is perfect. That has a lot to do with reinforcing his sense of discernment, his sense of particularity. It happens with just about every detective in the series, and it's actually what more modern or postmodern detective novelists are responding to, people like Henry Mantel and even Paul Auster in the New York trilogy, the idea of the anti-detective detective novel, the schlumpy guy who has no interest in his clothing, who just is wearing whatever he happens to be wearing. That's
Saul Panzer.
So what?
Saul Panzer.
Exactly. So that's sort of in conversation with that. Particularly in Three Doors to Death, there's an important historical moment in the depiction of a fashion show. Fashion shows come out of the mid-19th century with Charles Frederick Worth and the rise of the French couturier. It's a huge moment in terms of the physical presentation of a design aesthetic, which had not happened earlier. That was something that typically you would be invited to view a set of garments. You would come, you would look at the stuff, decide what to buy, and you would leave. And the designers would present to all of their clients on a couture system. So fashion shows start around 1870, 1880. By the early teens, fashion shows come to New York, and the fashion district has moved from the seaport to what is modern-day Soho. And by the time Three Doors to Death comes out, fashion is located in what some still argue is its present home in the fashion district in New York on 7th Avenue between about 32nd and 39th Streets. So there's a fashion show depicted in the series, the idea of models depicted, obviously Stout's wife as a textile designer, which I learned 27 minutes ago. So it's a semi-public presentation of designs. It's extremely important within fashion history. In terms of mass consumption, detective novels function externally as participants in the consumption cycle, as they are objects which are consumed using disposable income by regular citizens. But at the same time, their internal function is a rhetoric that prizes subversion. So Nero Wolfe himself does not function within the American consumption system of his period. Think about it. What were people buying? Cheap newspapers and magazines, entertainments, novelties, candy. Not really his thing. People weren't buying geese to eat. They weren't buying fine beer. They weren't going to Savile Row to have their clothes made, fine clothing and accessories. They weren't buying fine, you know, China items like that. So what Wolf is buying is actually very countercultural for the time. It's deeply subversive. And yet his cultural products are sold on the streets. So it's a counter-dominant aesthetic discernment that is really important for distinguishing these kinds of detectives within their own series. And it happens pretty much in all of the detective novels. It's very hard to find an example of true genre period fiction that goes against that. I mean, I'd be open if anybody can think of one, but usually they fit fairly solidly within that. And again, the more modern detective novelists are responding to that and are in conversation with that trend. From a religious or theological perspective, he functions in a high moral system. It's capitalist. He gets financial rewards for ethical actors. He's non-state. It's a private enterprise of worldly justice. Where possible, Wolf is in response to the technology of violence. This was a very, very important trend with people like Edgar Rice Burroughs, Rex Stout, Agatha Christie, and even today with a lot of modern detective novels, you notice these people aren't fond of guns. And we look at that today as kind of an interesting quirk that might help develop a brand. We tend not to think of the gun as a technological innovation for systematizing violence, which it was from about 1910 all the way through the 60s. The gun was something that had mechanized violence and mechanized warfare, especially for people like Rex Stout, who were in response to the events of World War I. So mechanized violence is something that these authors are consciously responding to. And it is, in and of itself, we would argue, an aesthetic choice above all else. Wolf does not stand deeply opposed to violence. He stands deeply opposed to mechanical and technological violence. So he's not all that opposed to hitting somebody if he needs to, or getting somebody out of the way in any sort of violent way, but if you'll notice, he doesn't pick up a gun to do it. And he doesn't like using guns, but he also has a kind of acceptance of firearms as important, because he keeps them. One of the lost elements of detective novel studies is that pulps were particularly important to Frankfurt School Marxists and post-Marxists from the beginnings of examining popular culture. The first time historians start to look at what regular people are reading and said, you know, the Magna Carta is great, but nobody at the time knew what it was or had read it. So we're a little bit more interested in what everyday people were eating, what they wanted to be eating, what they were wearing, what they wanted to be wearing, what they were reading. And in literary studies and textual analysis, it's what they thought they ought to be reading versus what they were actually reading. So these people understood that the Bible was something you ought to have read, and yet the Nero Wolf novel was more likely tucked safely inside that. So it's important in terms of the intellectual heirs like Baudrillard, Levi-Strauss, and Hebdige even. We've sort of lost this with the textualization of non-textual cultural products. Now we tend to interpret everything in popular culture as a text in and unto itself for deconstruction and analysis, at least for the post-structuralists. It's a little harder to do that when your text is a text, when it's an actual book that you're assessing, because then you have the text and you have the response to the text, both cinematically and within a wider cultural audience. So the sense of identity as a series of concentric performances contingent upon external perception of the artifice of identity is huge within the beginning of popular cultural studies. A little bit later, anti-fashion, the anti-fastidious protagonists of Auster's Edgar Award-winning 1981 New York trilogy, and the rhetorical inversion of detective novel tropes becomes something that people sort of like to chew on, both on a plot level and on a level of visual aesthetics. So the idea of a murder that turns out to be a suicide, a classic flip of the potboiler, is what these people are in conversation with. To make connections to other speakers, just to touch briefly upon the law, Wolf functions as much outside the law as he does in it, both in terms of his aesthetic norms, and yet his role reinforces codified law as much as it steps outside of it, just like his clothing choices, while they're outside dominant cultural norms of the period, they follow unto themselves their own kind of codified system. So it's not like Wolf might show up wearing anything. We have a pretty good idea what Wolf is going to wear, the kind of objects of which he would approve and disapprove. So he sort of operates by his own set of rules. And if you guys have any questions about specifics within the novels, how they fit, how they're studied, how they're taught these days, or where they're taught, I can kind of address that, because my background is kind of in academia, as you may have guessed from some of the polysyllabic jabs.
Yes.
The point that you made about
Wolf
being countercultural and the things that he prizes are not what you would have cooking prizes.
in similar areas, Dr. Dale Sayers, in order which advertise, Whimsy goes to work sort of undercover in an advertising agency, and there's a whole section there where he says that he realizes how important advertising is to people who, when he wants them as a rich person, he still has to buy it, but it was critically important to people who didn't have a lot of money to channel their desires into the things that people wanted to sell to them.
And there's another dual irony. If you notice within the series, somebody always says to Nero Wolfe, I heard about you from someone. That's a very organic form of publicity. And yet the novels themselves were a very early product of huge mass marketing in terms of bookstore cutouts, you know, local advertisements, even radio broadcasts, tie-ins with products and product promotion. It's kind of a weird contrast to the way the books are promoted versus the way the fictional detectives promote their services.
Can you give an example of that?
An example of?
Oh, the commercial tie-ins?
Oh, commercial tie-ins. Detective novels were some of the first products associated with radio broadcasts and advertisers. Also, in some of the early detective novels, there were actually advertisements for other things printed on the back of the books to save money. In some cases, the store tie-ins involved cutouts of the fictional detectives, which we all take for granted now going to Barnes & Noble. But in the 1920s, with offset lithography and cardboard production costs, that was not cheap, and that was something that was really a visual way of promoting a very textual artifact.
To go back to, I have two questions, but to go back to Mary's point, what, the fact that he bought the suits, not necessarily on Savile Row, but the fact that they were Ann Taylor, that they Archie did buy Salk and Ties. I remember growing up in the 50s and hearing my father say, cheap is cheap. You buy a suit that's going to last for 40 years, and at least for men's fashion, is not really going to go out of style. Maybe skinny ties versus white ties. But is there, so what I guess I'm asking is, isn't the fact that he wanted good china and that he wore good clothes more maybe a product of a European background, of
this
a cultural background,
this
rather
is something
than
that
anti-culture?
Historically, we kind of misperceive this. The idea that in the past people bought things of enduring quality. One, all things were made better. So that's actually historically true.
Yes.
Having done assessments of historical garments, I can tell you they were made much better. And everything was handmade, so you couldn't really get a machine-made suit. And ironically, the first people wearing machine-made suits paid a lot of money for them, seen as a novelty. So Wolf is buying things that are a lot more expensive, sort of geometrically more expensive than the average citizen. A suit of clothes at the time the Wolf novels come out cost between $1.75 and $4. The stuff Wolf's wearing is easily $10 to $30 a pop. That's really expensive stuff. Most of it's imported. And when we say hand tailoring, we mean not piecework done on the Lower East Side. We mean a fine tailor shop that would have your measurements and create bespoke suits. So everybody wore things for longer, but someone like Wolf actually was almost doing the opposite. So he wore things for a long time, but we get a sense reading the novels, he had a lot of this stuff.
Right.
He was not wearing three suits. This was a guy with a big closet.
He actually mentioned in the book that he used to change his shirt more than once a day.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. My other question is, in the books, both Wolf and Archie wear a fair amount of brown suits, which today just seems like, I hope I'm not going to offend them, very few people wear brown suits, at least for men. Sorry, Peter. was this reflective of the times of as the color brown for men's clothes went out of fashion?
It's reflective of a cultural things of a few things culturally and intellectually.
Textile.
Color and textile had a lot greater importance in the past. For example, I look at the audience, some of you were wearing purple. For centuries that was a no-no, and everybody understood what the color purple meant. It meant that you were part of the aristocracy or a cleric. The idea of wearing black around 1890, somebody would have said, are you coming from a funeral? Today we say that jokingly. That was pretty serious. Or are you a priest? Are you a lawyer? Well, you know, what is your job? It had a lot more to do. Yeah, it had a lot more to do with who you are. So color brown was more popular, and also brown was a much more neutral color for men to be wearing. There was a much narrower color palette.
And in the same venue, what does the cape say about Nero at this point in his
style? That was only in the TV series.
I would argue that the cape has as much to do with the extremely large closet,
yes,
out of which he never came. And his lack of relation to women specifically, and these very vague references in the past, but and I think that's a pretty strong part of the detective. And there's a lot of questions.
Hi, I'd like to say that my dad wore brown suits.
Thank you.
In fact, I would say probably 80% of his closet was.
Was brown?
Was brown.
Oh.
And Nero Wolfe's appreciation of good quality and expecting things to last were both my father's philosophy and my mother's, definitely. This was how we were brought up.
Were yellow shirts and pajamas common?
No.
Yellow was pretty outre because you couldn't get it, because synthetic yellow dyes were not particularly widely used up until really the 40s and 50s. The process of making that fabric is a lot more expensive. Also, if you think about it, just on a simple level, yellow is a pretty impractical color. You can bleach white. You can dye black. You can't really do anything with yellow if it gets dirty. So in terms of what people did with the clothing, yellow is pretty disposable. It's a lot like pink. People think today, pink is a color associated with women. Women didn't wear a whole lot of pink before about the 1950s because there's not a lot you can do to launder it. You can't re-dye it. You can't bleach it. So it's gone when it gets a stain on it.
These would be the brown suits. I can remember being brought to Brooks Brothers when I was about 9 or 10, for a specific reason. It was too long to get into, but we needed specific color clothing, and then one good suit. And the tailor very overt, I'm not even sure how to describe it, but very strongly hinting and even stating that you don't wear brown suits anymore because people don't trust people in brown. A prevailing trope all the way through the early, mid, and late 60s up until the early 70s. I remember hearing that in more than one good clothing store. Don't wear brown. People don't trust people who wear brown suits. It's a salesman suit.
And especially even the idea of being a little bit overdressed and fussy about your clothing, when the Wolf novels start coming out along with all the other detective novels and pulps, that's considered a sign of nobility, respectability, honesty, and success. In today's culture, we don't look at things that way.
Yeah.
So somebody who shows up at your door wearing a suit that looks just a little too slick, or maybe a tuxedo where a suit would be more appropriate, we tend to think, what are they trying to pull on us? That was not the case. And that's one of the many areas in which the detective genres sort of become bypassed by popular culture.
Well, nowadays, if you call someone a suit, it's not good.
Exactly. Even the phrase, a suit.
Could you comment on Wolf's choice of headgear? Even today, I think the choice of headgear in all classes of society is a statement by the wearer of the image he wants to project of himself publicly in attitude, status, and everything else. And probably that more one thing more than anything else indicates something about Wolf.
It's a necessity for Rex to comment on the hat because everybody wore hats. So to say he put on a hat today, we might think, oh, he's wearing a hat. How fussy, How dapper, whatever, how foppish. Everybody wore hats. So if you're going to put your protagonist in a hat, if he's that careful about the colors he's choosing in his silk pajamas and his beer and his orchids and his house and everything about his aesthetic, he's not putting on a fedora. Like, it's not going to pop on the page.
He had a Borsellino hat, probably.
Exactly.
If you didn't see last night's movie.
last night.
Which Wolf goes out as if going to the North Pole, and he's wearing a fur hat with flaps and pieces, and he looks ludicrous, but it's way over the top.
It's literally
but that's the movie, not the book.
But that wasn't Rex Stout, that was the director or whoever.
True. In the 30s and 40s when the books were written, would someone like Mr. Stout and Archie have dining alone, dressed for dinner?
It's largely dependent upon their social class. So dinner was eaten typically at about 2 p.m. for most people. In the series, they eat a little later than that.
7:15.
Exactly. The reason they eat later, it's a sign of social status. You eat dinner at 2 o'clock because you got to be at work at 6 in the morning and you're typically doing manual labor. So you want something hearty at 2 o'clock. If you're eating dinner at 7:15, it means you're not doing manual labor. It means your day is spent kind of lounging around reading papers, obviously working more with your brain than with your hands. So that in and of itself is a social indicator. Most people actually, the reason that people dressed for dinner, we misunderstand it as this sort of folksy element of dressing up and having respect. It's really because if you have concrete dust all over your clothing and lead on your fingers, you're not going to eat food like that. So you would change your clothing, which we misinterpret as dressing up for dinner. Whereas in Wolf's case, it was actually dressing up. He's going from a suit to a nicer suit, or from a suit to another suit. So most people were changing out of coveralls. Most people were changing out of clothing that you really wouldn't be considered worthy to eat in with things on their hands. So you would wash and you would dress for dinner.
Well, that brings to mind sometimes, to dinner, do you? When you see some of these movies, how the Englishmen are out in the jungle, and they're wearing whatever they wear in the jungle, and then when dinner comes, they bring out the table and the fine china, and they wear the whatever they wear, tuxedos and so forth, and they're really dressed for dinner, and they have the servants bring them the food and so forth.
And these things were huge social indicators. I mean, we tend to think, you know, the famous line historians say is that everyone thinks that everyone in the past was the wealthiest 1%, not to get too close to the Occupy Wall Street movement. But people didn't really treat dining all that formally. Even the idea of eating with utensils was not really culturally systematized, even in America, up until about after World War II, and that has mainly to do with soldiers' mess kits. So people might have a fork and a knife at the table. They were spending a lot of time ripping food apart and stuffing it in their mouths. Only the very, very elite, highly educated people were really sitting with a knife and fork and understood how to use a table service. If you had sat the average person down at a fully set table at a place like the Ritz, circa 1920, the average person would have no idea what to do with pretty much anything other than being able to identify things as utensils or containers. That's about all they could have done.
So you said that the techno-novel is sort of a manifestation of popular culture's frustrations with not being able to, you know, sort of having power within society. And they're living out their fantasies through this escape genre. But at the same time, Merkstout is choosing subjects like publishing or fashion, you know, for who the murderer is or big business. So is he commenting on kind of like the reality that some of these villains that people are seeing in popular culture that they would like to get at? I mean, besides just the person next door that's ripped them or something.
I mean, I think there is a lot of the sort of gemeine mensch versus Ubermensch dichotomy going on there. If you look at the pop culture heroes of the Depression, bank robbers, for example, today, people who stick guns in other people's faces and demand money, really not our favorite people in society. And at the time, these were heroes. These were people that everybody wanted to sort of look up to in a way, because the people against whom they were acting were considered enemies. Some people would argue that we've gotten slightly close to that with sympathy for certain leftist protesters. I would argue we're really not even close to that. For example, if one of the people at Occupy Wall Street took a trash can and threw it through the window of a Starbucks, I would guess most people would say, oh, how terrible. They wouldn't say, that's awesome. You know, I wish they would have burned the Starbucks. We're not really quite there yet. We're kind of all still.
But if they turned it to a bank?
I would argue people would be very afraid, because in the beginning of Occupy Wall Street, actually, there were discussions of the idea of kidnapping bankers and holding them at ransom. And even people on the left said, no, no, no.
So are most of these fiction novelists, in a way, they're subversive? They're
well, it's complicated. They're a little bit subversive, but not really, because if you notice, they all function on a perfect sort of moral landscape. So rape is never valued, destruction of property is never valued, theft is never valued. They function within a pretty standard set of Christian principles, even going Christian into the level of questioning state authority and the idea that the state actors are not always acting for the ultimate good, which I would imagine every lawyer fan of the Nero Wolf novels has a moment of squeamishness thinking, well, yeah, but where does this guy get his authority? Like, he's just kind of, you know, he's smart, that's great, but there's no systemization of this. There's no regulation, there's no licensing, there's no...
Well, there is actually.
Well, there is licensing, but there, you know, from a liabilities perspective, detective novels have got to be a little bit sort of squishy, but I would imagine. But you're the expert.
I know I read a lot of the detective novels because in the sense of the bad guy gets caught and mostly gets justice for the wronged person, whoever the victim was. You can download it, use the paper, and I come from Massachusetts, which has a terrible history of... Oh, politicians are in jail, and you know, the next politician does just as bad, and he's in jail. And you want someone to come up and say, well, I can solve this and make everything right.
And if you want to sound like total nerds talking to your friends later, What we call that in cultural studies is a systematized ideological state apparatus reinforcing Gramscian hegemony within a larger sphere.
But I got it on tape.
Or to some of us, you just said, the bad guys get caught, and we smile and put the book down and they go back.
I will shoot for the coyote.
So that's the technical.
Well, when you think of the movies like the Godfather series, you know, in some ways, you say, gee, I wish I had somebody like the Godfather who could get that jerk who did whatever this to my family or to me or whatever.
And if you think about it, if you're an average person, you know, you're working all day, your paycheck's tiny, you have no health care, you have no health insurance, probably have no unemployment insurance. It's rewarding to see somebody get the bad guy. And yet, if you really start to think about it, it gets complicated because the guy who's doing all the good work and the guy who's getting the bad guy is nothing like you and probably would have nothing to do with you in real life or wouldn't even want to talk to you. So there's kind of a weird...
There's at least one novel where a wolf, you know, gets a murderer and deals with the murderer, and Kramer said, you know, why didn't you leave it to me to deal with it? Kramer said, because you, using your rules and your standards, wouldn't have been able to prove he was guilty, so I took care of it for you. There were at least two other novels where Wolf, although he has the evidence on the murderer, basically lets the murderer, tomorrow you're going to be arrested, and the way it works back then is, you know, the murderer then killed himself or herself. That was many times. Kramer made it very clear, the law is supposed to deal with this rule system, care about your law, the bottom line is that the guilty person, you know, there's no other route. I don't think so.
Also, these novels, if you think about it, all take kind of an a priori view of the law. They don't really view the law as a set of social constructs and a social contract created by citizens in a functioning democracy. They view the law kind of as just something that exists, a posteriori. It's out there. Somebody else has created a them, an other, and the government is in and of itself an other, which isn't really the case, as I'm sure anyone would.
Last question.
Several times during what you were saying, some of your responses, you used the expression at that time. Now, since Webb Stout wrote over a span of about 40 years and his character evolved over that span, I wonder where you're positioning yourself to make that statement. When you were talking about the hats, for example, early in the radio age, maybe everybody wore a hat, but deep into the television age where the character Nero Wolfe survived, he was still not leaving house without his Homburg.
It's two elements.
Where are you mentally positioning yourself when you say at that time?
One would be a functional rhetoric of nostalgia. The other would be, it's not just about Wolfe as a character, because we all know he doesn't age. It's about the readers. So in 1975, you still have a lot of people within a reading audience who would have assumed a gentleman should go out wearing a hat, even if they had stopped doing it. So even if they were in response to dominant popular culture, they would still like the idea, and you know, people have a pretty reasonable lifespan. You're talking about a reader who could reach age 75, somebody born around 1900, they would have assumed someone should be, like anybody born up to around really 1930 would have had that set of aesthetic assumptions. So well into even the 80s, that was a fairly common thing for the readers. It's more about the perceptive audience in terms of what Stout is reacting to and in conversation with than it is about actual trends in the 80s or 70s or 60s. And I think the posthumous one was published in 85?
75. A moment after he died.
Okay. Because I thought there was one whose first edition was 85, but I could be wrong.
It's a collection. Oh, it's actually a collection I refer to as Alternate Endings from the magazine that I haven't been published yet. It's not a good long story.
Seems like we have more questions, but we can do that later. I'll stick around.